Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Bring it back.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at eplroundtable@gmail.com.
Hi guys, I'm Jim. I'm the Leicester City representative for the EPL Roundtable. You can find me on Twitter at
JimKnight88. Hi, I'm Steve McGookin. I'm a former chairman of the New York Spurs supporters club, and you can get me on Twitter at Steve McGookin.
All right, thanks so much for joining us today, guys. Not so much of a light topic today. Previously, we had discussed with our Manchester City correspondent if we wanted to really dive in on some of the nasty headlines that have been written about Raheem Sterling over the past. Never seemed an opportune time to do it, and now it's just out in the open after what's happened at the weekend. For those that don't know, during the Manchester City-Chelsea match, at Stamford Bridge, some fans were racially abusing Raheem Sterling, and it was caught very clearly on video. That has resulted in 4 suspensions for the people that were caught in that clip. First of all, obviously this has happened plenty of times to both Raheem Sterling and other black players. Just last week, a banana was thrown in the direction of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang in the North London Derby. But one of the reasons why there's been so much coverage, and then we're obviously going to be included in that, is that Raheem Sterling responded. And he's tended to shy away from the media in the past on this issue and on other issues, but he has been very unfairly treated in the media. I think most people would agree up to this point, and he finally called it out. We'll start with his specific complaint and his Twitter message. He brought up 2 different headlines from the Daily Mail, focusing on Phil Foden and Adebayo, who both bought parents for their mothers. One just said, Phil Foden, the whiter player, that he bought his mother a £2 million home. The other one brought up that Adebayo, they brought up his wages, the price of the home, that he hadn't played for Manchester City yet in a senior match. What do you guys think of both the racial incidents at the weekend and how Sterling responded first?
Well, I'll kick off. I think Sterling was right and actually quite restrained given the circumstances in his Instagram comments, Kev. And I'll come on to that in a second. But I suppose, first of all, it's disappointing that we don't have a black commentator on our show to talk about this. Just as it's disappointing that there aren't more black football writers generally, it's part of the general underrepresentation of minorities in the institutional structures of the game, and it's a perspective that's incredibly important if we want to try and fix this, and of course to make sure that the sport we love is something everyone can love, and that's why we're here. So with that in mind, I could just sort of point people to a piece by one black journalist, Darren Lewis at the Daily Mirror, who wrote yesterday that, and this is really interesting, he said, what has happened with Sterling's response? And he made the connection to athletes' activism in the U.S. and the Colin Kaepernick situation. Maybe, you could talk a little bit about that later. Mm. Is that basically what Sterling was doing is trying to show other black players that taking a stand against this sort of treatment, it's not just possible, but it's actually essential. Given what he's had to endure, not just on this one particular instance, the alleged abuse at Chelsea, but literally through the recent parts of his career, and we'll come on to talk about the media, but as far as the media is concerned, in terms of accountability, as well as I do, both sports writers and sports pages have always been a breed apart from the rest of the journalistic enterprise. You know, whether that's in how they report on speculation about transfers to how they identify and portray players and managers, particularly England managers, actually, who for whatever reason they think their readers are entitled to vilify, and they can be both bandwagon leaders and bandwagon jumpers in that. So, you know, the responsibility, he's right. I mean, the responsibility is there with the media to report these things in a sensitive and intelligent way without actually lumping people into camps. And I'll come on to talk a wee bit about that later. But I also, I don't know if you saw Piers Morgan's comments. I probably yeah. didn't help, I think, when he tried to equate, you know, the Sterling's treatment to the treatment of Wayne Rooney. And if you think back even further, you know, how David Beckham was universally attacked at every ground after being sent off in the World Cup. But I think the treatment of Sterling has been really on a different order, something quite different.
And seemingly with no cause.
Well, no, but it's also, it's acted as a catalyst now. I think, as you said in the intro, it's acted as a catalyst now that everybody has to think about this. And so that's a good first step. And in a way, the collective intelligence of Britain's sports reporters have decided that he is the latest collective target for somehow everything that's wrong with the game. But he has undoubtedly been treated much more harshly than any other players. And I don't know if you saw the PFA came out in its statement today in support of Sterling and to criticise how what they call, quote, a negative narrative influences public opinion and that certain sectors of the media have to be held to account. So, yeah, I think there definitely is a responsibility, and I think Sterling was absolutely right to say what he said.
Yeah, the issue that's so striking, and it's obvious why Raheem pointed this out in his Instagram post, is that it almost seems like, certainly here, I won't say all black players, because obviously there have been plenty of discussions recently about, say, why Marcus Rashford isn't subject to similar stories to that of mm-hmm. Raheem Sterling. It does seem like Raheem Sterling is at the front and centre of this, which for no real reason other than he's very, very good at football and the colour of his skin, seemingly. He's being made a target for non-footballing reasons. And that is, you know, some people will say what happens on the pitch is fair game, a bad performance. And, you know, Piers Morgan's example of David Beckham being sent off is an on-the-pitch antic. That is within a sports writer's ballpark to criticise a player who made what I'm sure he would openly admit now was a stupid decision at the time. Raheem Sterling's criticism seems to come from a different place entirely, and it seems to go along with this rhetoric of kind of edging towards the left of the political... the right of the political agenda. And it ends up with footballers being criticised for things like buying their parents' houses. I mean, the example that he pointed out, of Phil Foden, the stories are virtually identical and yet they're reported in such a different way. And John Barnes made a few fantastic points. He did an interview on the BBC Breakfast Show this morning, Monday, as we record. And I'd urge anyone who's kind of got an interest in this topic to dig out the YouTube clip, which is about 7 minutes long. And he talks so eloquently and articulately about problems within wider society and how certain sections of the population based on ethnicity or religion are being marginalised, and therefore it's creating this negative rhetoric that's being replicated in football. Football isn't the problem here, but it is a magnifying glass for problems that are within our wider society. And he goes on to say, and I'm totally in agreement with him on this, that football can't solve these problems, because the next step, the next logical step for a lot of people off the back of this Raheem Sterling story will be, how does football solve its racism problem? Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely, yes, it might be the focal point at this particular moment in time. It is absolutely not the wider issue. And football can address, you know, its racism problem however it would like to. If that negative rhetoric towards certain members of our society is being peddled by the media, both in a wider front page and back page context, that problem is going to continue. And then the media does have a responsibility in the way that it addresses these various different people in various different ways. There is no good reason to report that those two very, very similar stories in completely different ways, other than you have an underlying issue with one of those players and it's not down to their footballing ability. And it's just, yeah, Raheem Sterling is right to call it out. And goodness knows how many times he's been subjected to these stories and he's probably wished he could call them out. And it's almost like now it's happened on the pitch. It's given him the leeway to be able to make that statement, because he probably didn't feel like he wanted to or was confident enough to necessarily do it, or just didn't want the hassle. And who can blame him?
Yeah.
When the story comes out about how much he spent on his house, how much his mum's bathroom cost when he had it refitted, there's another story that I remember seeing kind of way back when. And it almost, you know, also, he is a footballer who's investing in property. People in other areas of or other people in football, like Robbie Fowler, for example, who invested in property a lot when he was playing and is by the sounds of it, reaping the benefits of owning half of Liverpool and Manchester. You know, from a financial perspective, a kind of if that was a footballer, a non-black footballer, or a footballer from outside the black and ethnic minority group, then they might well be praised for their entrepreneurial spirit, you know, their way of looking at alternative incomes off the pitch, with the problems with footballers being, you know, a lot of them being bankrupt a few years after earning millions and millions of pounds a year. Mm-hmm. It's the way it's reported is completely, you know, different. But to go back to the Daily Mail point, the Daily Mail peddle a far-right rhetoric on the front page of their newspaper. And that is only being reflected in the back page. But that's the point. The point is that you can't suddenly row back on that rhetoric on the back page and expect people not to read the front page story about migrants and how they're to blame for this, that and the other. And, you know, or how certain people are vilified on the front page of the paper, and not expect that to seep into wider society. Because as much as the print industry is in decline, particularly the Daily Mail, Mail Online is a media juggernaut. It's read so widely that that kind of stuff does start to seep into wider society. And I've no doubt that there are people who harbour those feelings from their past, and whatever has happened to them is their business. But that only legitimises their viewpoint, and that is inevitably going to make its way into other areas of society that include sport, and in this case, particularly football.
Yep, I absolutely agree with that. And actually, Darren Lewis makes the point, the contrast in the print media and broadcast media. He makes the point in his piece yesterday. And he talked about this idea that, you know, the Sterling story for broadcasters is like 5 or 6 minutes of airtime before they move on to whatever the next thing is. But for black people, it's a microcosm of their lives. That was his actual quote. And he's right. I mean, racism is prevalent in every part of our society, whether it's in, you know, employment and earning power, housing, educational opportunities. And we've had the debate, you know, recently about access to higher education places and or relationships within the legal system. And I think if you accept that that is there, and you add that to the fact that you're never going to be able to eradicate racism from society completely. So while, as you say, Jim, football is a societal activity, there will inevitably be supporters who are racist. And allied to that, there have always been people who believe, just standard football supporters, who believe that buying a ticket and entitles them to say whatever they want and hurt whoever they want in the process. So, you know, there is, although it is a societal issue, and you're right, it's not, you know, football can't fix that. There is a responsibility on football and for the clubs to basically, you know, how do they define what is acceptable behavior and what's not? And that's long been an issue for clubs and how they think about their relationship with the people who come through the turnstiles, you know, every week. But there is, and you hinted at it, Jim, but there is actually something else that needs to be pointed out. And I don't want to get political, but it's important in terms of how our civic discourse is evolving. And it's no coincidence, we talked about this before we went on air, but it's no coincidence really that Britain's going through something of a social convulsion at the moment over Brexit, which has, I think it's fair to say, emboldened some people to believe that certain opinions are now more mainstream and it's somehow acceptable to voice them in public. And you know, you made the point about the Daily Mail and the Daily Express and attitudes to immigrants. But I think that, you know, regardless of how Brexit resolves itself, the country is divided. The country is permanently divided, and it's in the process of dividing further along age lines, with those implications for how, you know, we all as a collective, as a country, define what's acceptable. But I think one of the end results, like it or not, is going to be that some people are going to more strongly believe that they're entitled to say what they like, no matter how incendiary that might be. And as you say, the readership of those sorts of papers might influence people in terms of how they respond to clickbait headlines, clickbait articles, things that are designed to gin up controversy and create argument on the message boards. And of course, you know, the instant outrage of social media doesn't help and hasn't helped. I mean, to get away to another subject for a second, all you have to do is do a Twitter search for James McLean around poppy time. And, you know, we also saw it this year with Nemanja Matic for different reasons, to see how opinions become hatreds and whether or not we actually really value anyone's individual right to stand up and protest about something. So, yeah, I mean, it's all part of the same kind of snowball effect, I think, for want of a better expression, of how something gets escalated very, very quickly and how we stand up to it and fix it.
Yeah, I really like that point that you brought up, because it does seem like this kind of self-sustained cycle of our readership craving and clicking on content that has controversial headlines like that, encouraging papers to push more and more aggressive narratives, which gets more and more praise. And then as all that's happening, as Jim was pointing out earlier, then it encourages and I think, as you said, Steve said, embraces readers with those points of view to share them more publicly. But I think also interestingly, as we were mentioning earlier, that this has dragged everything into the spotlight. Again, trying to not get too political, but in the States, recent events in politics have also brought out more and more racist issues, which in the long term, I suppose, could end up being better than if all of those things had just remained buried. But it certainly does not make things enjoyable to have to deal with right now. We mentioned earlier the 4 suspensions for the Chelsea fans that were there. This seems to be the go-to for clubs when situations like this happen. But considering the rate at which they keep happening, do you think suspensions could be effective, or do you think there's something else that needs to be done to try to prevent this in the ground? Or, as you guys were saying, is the issue more cultural than football?
I'm not sure what more the clubs can do other than bans, to be honest. And I think it's like any other form of punishment. Once you ban somebody for life, for example, I mean, that's, you're setting the bar. That means that every other instance of a similar offense or a similar transgression has to be punished by a similar level of punishment. So I'm not sure beyond just that what the clubs themselves can do, but they do have a responsibility to, in the process of how they punish people who are found guilty of these. And you know, it's worth pointing out that the Chelsea suspensions today, for example, are while the investigation's going on. No one's actually been charged with anything yet. But the clubs have responsibility in the process of punishing people who are guilty of these things. They have a responsibility to try and set some kind of moral code by defining what they think is acceptable behavior or what they think their fans should aspire to. As supporters of Chelsea, as supporters of Leicester, as supporters of Tottenham Hotspur, you're supposed to aspire to a sense of collective responsibility and moral values. If that's probably, you know, pie in the sky stuff, but I think the clubs have responsibility to actually try and set that moral code, as well as punishing people, or do it in the process of punishing people.
Yeah, it's the only real recourse the club have in terms of suspension while the investigations are ongoing. and then enforcing bans if deemed appropriate based on the findings of those reports. But it is, you know, it's also down to them to help the authorities from a legal standpoint to fully identify what actually went on and then contribute to that legal kind of system if need be. You know, these are essential, you know, racially abusing someone or abusing someone based on the color of their skin or their sexual orientation, it can be viewed as a hate crime, and it should be, you know, viewed as such regardless of whether or not it happens in a city center on a Saturday night or at a football club on a Saturday afternoon. It ultimately, as Steve rightly says, the club have, and I'm sure will, if found guilty, publicly admonish those offenders and kind of take every step they can that's deemed appropriate in terms of punishment. And that's absolutely fine. And, you know, Kev, as you said, in terms of it happening on a regular basis now, that's a sad state of affairs, but you just have to take that relatively, you know, not even hard line, just appropriate measure, and hope that the banning orders or whatever punishment is administered to those people acts as a deterrent. No one's expecting, I don't think anyone's expecting that to suddenly mean that racism isn't in football, but at least it may act as a deterrent for those who may have tendencies in that direction not to act that way at a football ground, you know, because of the consequences of doing so. And I know that isn't solving the core issue, but again, as I was speaking about earlier, and I think John Barnes put it better than I ever could, and obviously comes at it from a much more informed, much more eloquent standpoint, given what he's been through in his career and when he was playing, it has to be, football can't be the be all and end all for this, but it can certainly be a start. And, you know, hopefully it shows off the back of this investigation that is simply not acceptable in any strata of society, let alone at a football ground. I think going back to what Steve was saying, the issue with football is that it's such a tribal exercise. Going to a football game, there is, you know, and one of the great things that we love about sport and football in particular is there are relatively few things in life that bring together so many people in such a kind of tribal way. It's the only way I can really describe it. There are very few things in modern life that galvanize that kind of number of people together in such a short period of time and in such a small geographic location. And I think as much as that is something that we love about football and, you know, the fandom and the kind of family values almost that are adopted by football clubs, they're seen as centers of society and communities, and they're hubs and places for people to go, and they often act as support mechanisms when people are going through tough times, and it provides people from different backgrounds with common ground, you know, when you support the same football team, and it gives you that instant kind of recognition of someone else, and you instantly understand what that person likes necessarily about that football club, or, you know, what they've gone through if they've been a supporter for, you know, the similar time to you have. You'll have been through similar things as supporters of that football club. But unfortunately, that tribal kind of pack mentality also can bring out the worst traits in people, because it allows those people that those kind of negative feelings, if they're there under the surface, not only to surface, but to kind of go uninhibited, because for those 2 hours on a Saturday afternoon or Saturday evening, whenever the game is played, those people often see it as a release. It's the focal point of people's weeks. And unfortunately, you know, if people are allowed to express those opinions, sometimes they're going to stray into things that aren't deemed acceptable by wider society, and they just need to be punished as such, because, you know, it isn't acceptable and it shouldn't ever have a place in football. And while, like I say, I'm not expecting football to address it overnight, the best thing that any club who's kind of embroiled in this can do is, once the people are found guilty, or if they are indeed found guilty — we don't want to assume guilt on anybody's part at this point, specifically at this point with regards to the Chelsea fans — once the investigation is over, if they are indeed found guilty of what is being alleged, they should be punished to the full effect of the football club's ability. And that, unfortunately, well, I say unfortunately, actually, in reality, that ends at banning orders, because the football club don't have the legal jurisdiction to go further. Then it's in the hands of the Metropolitan Police and for them to follow up on it from a legal standpoint, which is a completely different story. But the football club have an obligation to work with those authorities to ensure that, you know, that investigation continues outside of a footballing context if required.
Yeah. No, I think that tribalism point is really important, Jim, actually. And I'm reminded of, I think it was Simon Cooper, who wrote a book about tribal identifications in international football. And he called international competitions like the World Cup and the Euros a peaceful form of war. In that it's how national rivalries can be acted out in a relatively sort of insulated environment. And I was just curious. I mean, when we talk about the punishments, we talk about the banning orders and that sort of thing, just to stay with international football for a second, does anyone know how effective the banning orders that were imposed on England fans, for example, is there a way of sort of following up to know whether those are actually effective or not? If you can stop people traveling to games, is that a more effective way of punishing them? But I mean, Jim's absolutely right. This is it's a social issue, but it's also something that if there's an offence committed, the offence shouldn't matter where the offence is committed or the context in which it's committed. If it's like on social, if you wouldn't say something on social that you would say to someone's face, or you shouldn't say something on social that you wouldn't say to someone's face. It's the same. It's the same mentality, I think. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, how do clubs actually deal with that within the sanctions that exist for them that are agreed and accepted and understood by the supporters' clubs, for example, who they know that if they transgress, that there will be certain punishments that go along with it. But that tribalism as well, it brings up an interesting point that there is that. As increasingly everyone polarizes, that there is this tribal identification that, you know, everything my side does is right, everything your side does is wrong. It sort of reinforces this echo chamber effect where people only want to hear voices that endorse their previously held beliefs. And it brings up that interesting question that we haven't addressed yet is how, you know, how these so-called supporters regard black players who play for their own team and how they may or may not see the contradiction in that. I mean, for example, the guys who, you know, allegedly yelled at Sterling probably loved Didier Drogba, for example. So there is that inherent tribal contradiction.
Yeah, and we certainly see that in the States with college football in particular, but the NFL as well, of racism being shown towards people of a race on the other team. But it kind of follows that you're one of the good ones mentality that exists to avoid contradiction for racists. If they know somebody of a different color and they're all right, then it's like, okay, well, you're all right. You're one of the good ones. But what about all those other ones? You're like, what other ones?
Well, that was the point you were making before we came on air, Kev, about the guy who threw the banana skin at Aubameyang.
Yeah. Yeah, for those that don't know, the guy that threw a banana skin at Aubameyang offered a half apology, where he started off by just claiming he wasn't racist, then said he was Greek, so he couldn't be racist, and then just basically kept backtracking further and further to where it really wasn't an apology at all. And he, unlike what's happened with the Chelsea fans, has actually been banned for life from Tottenham fans, which, as you guys were saying, seems to be club's best recourse for when this happens. On a larger scale, FIFA, of course, had an anti-racism task force that they disbanded a couple years back, claiming that the job was done. Then they followed up with a statement basically saying, we're not saying racism is gone, but a task force is a short-lived thing. But there don't really seem to be anything else other than just the continued campaign of say no to racism. Do you think if the clubs are limited to just being able to ban people from matches, that there should be something done more by football associations and perhaps FIFA and UEFA on that scale?
It's difficult because it's how far the reach of the football clubs go in terms of, particularly from a major international governing body like FIFA and UEFA. They obviously have a responsibility to you know, try and ensure that the game that they are administering is free of those kind of problems. But ultimately, it goes back to not only the wider societal point, but like an education standpoint as well. As Steve rightly kind of pointed out, the issue is that people will have those feelings in those crowds, and that will never go away. I don't think it's a nice idea to believe that it will, but unfortunately, human nature and the way that people act, and as we've seen in the last few years, and we've touched on a couple of times in this podcast already about the political climate leaning more towards those dividing lines and those things that are meant to polarize the debate, you know, those kind of things will mean that those views are being held at that point. It's not a good soundbite for FIFA to disband their racism task force, because obviously there is still issues, and there are still international teams, for example, that play behind closed doors in qualifiers and friendlies because of previous issues around racism. And, you know, we've seen those punishments administered since that task force has been disbanded. So, and no one, I don't think, is naive enough to believe that it's not going to be an issue. But I think the problem is how you access and how you build that into the grassroots of football supporter kind of fandom, if you like. It's so difficult because there is only so far as a football administrator you can reach. I guess your pinnacle is major tournaments, but the problems stem from way, way before those kind of showpiece events come about. And it's not an enviable task. Obviously, you have a duty to deliver the game in the format that you do, and you hope that it isn't marred by those. But as you rightly pointed out, Kev, you see not so many incidents, but you see the prevalence of those incidents in the last couple of years. And unfortunately, you know, Chelsea fans, when I think it was when they went to Paris, a group of supporters that are in Paris for a game against Paris Saint-Germain, and, you know, who were abusing someone in Paris, and that, you know, one of the leading motivations was clearly the colour of his skin. And, you know, it's how the international governing bodies or any governing body kind of attempts to tackle that. But I wholeheartedly believe the issue is in education, and it's in helping in that way. Football perhaps can be a useful vehicle in allowing people to understand that, you know, we're all human at the end of the day. It really shouldn't matter about the colour of your skin, your ethnicity, your sexual orientation, any kind of unique identifying factor that people believe kind of sets one person apart from the other. It really shouldn't matter. And actually, perhaps football has a wider reach than almost anything else in the world to get that message across. It's just an extremely difficult thing to administer because it's how you kind of get that message to people, because football, unless you are involved in like the grassroots side of things, which is obviously fantastic, if you can help breed that mentality that it doesn't matter into the young footballers of today, hopefully that will come through. And, you know, those people playing under nines, under tens football, even younger, you know, clubs, academies pick players up at 4, 5 and 6 these days. If those players go on to be the next generation or the future generations of football writers, hopefully that will start to seep into the media coverage and the broadcasting schedules of football and the wider kind of sporting context. But yeah, there's no easy fix, I don't think, because if there was, you'd have hoped even FIFA and UEFA, with all their relevant problems that we know about and we hear on a regular basis, hopefully they will have tried to address those. But it is very, very difficult beyond punishing people when those issues come to a head.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The education point, Jim, is absolutely crucial as well. I think that is something where the clubs can take a stand and get involved and actually work with local schools and local community groups, as well as working with their supporters groups as well. And I know certainly the Spurs have a media or a social outreach effort that goes into local schools and talks to kids about issues and that sort of thing, and works with them within the framework of identifying with the club, because that's, again, it gets back to this idea of what do we hold up as a model of how we want our club to be. And you know, the broader programs like Kick It Out or Rainbow Laces as well, which we saw just last weekend as well. Those are hugely important, but again, they come down to how the individual clubs manifest that. Is it just something that they do for the weekend, or again, to go back to the poppy situation, is that something that where the commitment continues through the year? It has to be an ongoing, and it has to be part of what we decide as supporters and members of a club, that those are the values that we want to hold our club to, and we want to hold up to the local communities and encourage them to be part of that. So yeah, I think that having the clubs involved in educational outreach, I think, is absolutely crucial, and that's a very good point.
Taking a step back from solutions for the football aspects with the clubs and FIFA and the like, what kind of course correcting needs to happen in the world of journalism to prevent this kind of unfair portrayal that Raheem Sterling in particular has received, as well as some of these younger players? Obviously, one of the reasons I wanted to have you both on is that you've both been in the media industry. So curious to get your take on how that side of things could be resolved or improved.
Well, I mean, alongside anything that clubs do, it's definitely something that's going to require journalists at some point to say, maybe we're not going to take the easy story here that we think reflects and reinforces what our readers are thinking and therefore will get us more clicks. But rather, just as the club has to hold up some kind of moral code, but rather papers have to try and act as kind of a moderating influence. But I mean, people are still going to read their pages. It's not, like readers are going to change to a paper that's more vitriolic and sort of drift away that way. Although it does raise issues about, and Jim, you've worked as a sports writer, you know more about this probably than I do, but it raises issues about the posse element of how sports writers hook onto the latest story and everybody follows the caravan on that. But it also does raise those issues about individual clickbait stories on social and how, as we were saying before, how headlines are deliberately constructed and deliberately written to be provocative and to encourage arguments basically within readers and to essentially then have stories that are perhaps provocative in that way mentioned on wider media, on Radio 5 Live or the BBC Breakfast or whatever that happens to be. And I think, unfortunately, that's just that's just where journalism is at the moment. I think there is this sort of economic anxiety that even among papers that are doing well, that sort of says, well, we have to go where the audience is. We have to actually chase the audience and reflect more of what we think their prejudices are, rather than actually try and hold up some kind of moderating presence to them. And it is the age old issue and the age old challenge of balancing what's in the public interest versus what interests the public. And at the end of the day, unfortunately, readers vote with their clicks. And unfortunately, I can't see anything fundamentally altering in the structure of how that's organized. Although it would be interesting for the first paper to try to take a moral stance on something like this, what sort of reaction they got.
It's increasingly, I think it's tough because I've never worked for a newspaper. So, I won't pretend to know the intricacies of particularly newspaper journalism. But the issue to me from an outside perspective looking in, and I'm going to stress this at this point, that, you know, it isn't talking as an insider of any particular organisation, but, you know, from a casual, almost from a, just from a football supporter's perspective, it seems like the retraction element of falsified or overblown or clickbait stories is virtually non-existent to a lot of publishers. Stories are put out into the wider world with an emphasis on being fast and first rather than being right or accurate. And unfortunately, that leads to mistakes or assumptions on certain people's part, and to some degree will engage people who are looking for those kind of stories because that's what they identify with. And as Steve rightly said, I think the right phrase is echo chamber. It's people will search out those kind of stories, and when they find them, they'll feel kind of just, it feels like it backs up their point of view, therefore they'll keep looking for it, and they'll look for people that share those points of view, and it just keeps going round and round and round. And unfortunately, stories like that will drive clicks, it will sell newspapers, and that is what unfortunately people will try to do. If a newspaper writes a story, I'm not gonna say that we should shed any tears over footballers because of the fantastic lifestyle they lead and the kind of it's not even down to the money, but the opportunities and stuff that they're afforded. But it must be increasingly difficult for people like Raheem Sterling in particular, or any footballer, to have news about your public private life, even kind of published on a daily or weekly basis, it seems like, for some people, and have no kind of recourse other than to basically let it happen, knowing full well that that's probably reinforcing the point of view that, even if it's wrong, it reinforces the point of view of those people who are, see you in a negative light already. And, Henry Winter did a piece in the Times last weekend, I think it was. He did a sit down interview with Raheem Sterling. He went to his house. He was very much kind of complimentary about Raheem and the way that he's approached his career since moving to Manchester City, in the sense of, he wants to be the best player he can be. And part of me does wonder whether the vitriol for Raheem Sterling over almost any other player I can think of in this day and age, certainly, is because of the whole kind of, it began potentially in the Liverpool to Manchester City transition, and the whole, footballers are greedy, but he's greedier than most. And that kind of gives people a stepping stone to make that next connection within that realm. And, as good as that piece was that Henry wrote, and it was excellent, it won't even reach the, the browsers or the social media space of people who believe the opposite. So the difficulty you're going to have is, as Steve mentioned, even if a paper takes a particularly kind of a particularly different view on this and tries to be a bit more moral and kind of to not report stuff, plenty of other people still will. And unfortunately, that's just the sad state that we're in. And people will still find that out, and it will still happen. I think as a whole, people just need to be held accountable maybe a bit more, because ultimately football writers can put it's the same when it comes to transfer season as well. And I have no doubt that, you know, fed stuff by people with conflicting interests, whether that be clubs or agents or players or, you know, representatives of those players to agitate for certain outcomes. And, you know, they report on them as such. And sometimes it works. You know, we saw Jorge Mendes put out a statement about Jose Mourinho and how pleased Manchester United were with his progress despite their ailing fortunes in the last couple of days. And people will always use that media narrative to suit their own agenda. Unfortunately, the paper do likewise when it comes to things like this, because I assume they write it because they know that it sells papers, or they suspect that it does, and it drives clicks. And it's almost like it needs an industry-wide kind of resolution, almost. But that's increasingly difficult to enforce. Press standards are increasingly difficult to enforce anyway. And we hear, you know, you see investigations and parliamentary committees in the UK come to kind of guidelines and standards, but it's increasingly difficult. There is, you know, very little backlash for a newspaper that publishes a story which is subsequently proven to be fabricated in some way, shape or form, or just, you know, outright lies. The same in the political agenda. Politicians can say, by and large, whatever they want with virtually no recourse whatsoever. And unfortunately, you know, some newspapers find themselves in a similar situation where they can publish a large variety of stories where, even if debunked further down the line, not only will most of the people that have read them and believed them and taken them in and probably repeated them as gospel as well, they'll never see those retractions or those clarifying statements or the kind of fact-checking element of that. And that's what just it ends up perpetuating those feelings within the wider society, I would imagine, or certainly contributes to it.
There is actually some academic research on the number of people who see a correction on social media, for example, and it's a small, insignificant proportion of the people who see the original post. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There is this sense of, you know, scoops are important, get a story out quickly, beat the competition if it's something you have to yourself. And everything that we've just talked about, when you apply it to something like the transfer market, for example, the papers know their audience. They know that they have a very dedicated group of readers who are interested in knowing very quickly about who might be moving from which club to which club. And so speculation, informed speculation is a legitimate legitimate form of debate within that area. But you're right, the key word is accountability. And as I say, you know, sports pages and sports writers have always sort of been held to a different standard almost than the rest of the media.
Yeah, as we begin to wind down here, in the aftermath of all of this and all those aspects, both on the pitch, in the stadium, fan bases, and the media on the whole, do you think things will start to get better soon with the actions that have been taken?
I mean, I hope so. It would be nice to believe that this could be something of a turning point and a watershed moment, because I hope that the way that, you know, the impassioned response from Raheem Sterling over the weekend perhaps is at the forefront of people's minds the next time they read a story about what has typically been a young player from a black or ethnic minority background outside of a footballing context. You know, the line between what is in, you know, it's already been said, but what is in the public interest and what is of interest to the public. The next time a story is, you know, put out about that, whether it be the next tattoo that a player gets, the next house they buy for a family member, you know, anything like that, I just hope this is at the forefront of people's minds, because actually, if that starts to change the perception of the way those stories are viewed, maybe that will impact on what is being written, because it's a vicious circle. As long as people keep reading it and interacting with it and squabbling in the comments, or, you know, retweeting it and getting all vitriolic on Twitter and goodness knows what else, people will keep writing that stuff. But actually, if this means that people view this in a slightly different way and say, and don't immediately retweet it as gospel and think, is this being written with an agenda outside of what I should expect of this publication from a footballing context? Maybe that will help the next step in this journey, which hopefully starts to turn this tide around of, you know, people being reported on seemingly in a negative light because of nothing else other than the color of their skin or their ethnic background or, you know, anything like that. It's just, yeah, I hope that people keep this in mind going forward, because it could also be a stark reminder of the ulterior motives that are at play within certain kind of areas of the media and how it's being reported.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I also hope that Raheem Sterling speaking out in the way in which he did, and as I say, I mentioned earlier, I thought given the circumstances, what he said was it was quite restrained.
Absolutely.
And I think him speaking out might actually act as a catalyst. And I think this is maybe where there is something that the clubs can do. If somebody at each of the Premier League clubs saw this happening this weekend and said, what would we do if that was our player? What action would we take if that was our player? And how do we act collectively to actually try and make it appear like we're imposing some kind of central standard? And maybe one way that they can do that is to regulate their access to the papers that are the worst offenders. Because, you know, the papers, the sports writers are nothing without access to the players. So maybe that there's something that the clubs can do to act in concert, to actually think about, well, you know, an injury to one is an injury to all, almost. And how can we as a product, because let's not forget the Premier League is a product more than anything else. How can we act to moderate the behavior of the media that we consider to be acting unreasonably?
Fair enough. Any final thoughts from you two?
Let's hope we don't have to have this conversation again, but I suspect, as we have said, you know, racism isn't going away. We just have to make sure that we try and find a way that everyone's involved in the solution to it, even though, you know, socially, societally, there's not really much football can do to change that, but they can change minds, I suppose.
Yeah, it would just be nice if this, you know, ultimately wasn't forgotten in 2 weeks' time when it's kind of out of the news cycle and it actually prompts something in terms of maybe making certain publications or certain writers who are responsible for putting out these kind of stories maybe think twice about them. You know, I have no issue with footballers being criticised based solely on their footballing performance, but this clearly isn't that. And that's the kind of issue. And talking about regulating access, it's not a case of wanting clubs to regulate the access of the publications that criticise them for their on-pitch activities or, you know, things within a footballing context. But when it goes beyond that, you know, it would be interesting to see a club take that kind of stand, and just to kind of see the impact that it has. I know, you know, certain publications have been banned from clubs in the past, but it tends to be more down to kind of rifts within the ownership of the club and, you know, negative headlines being written about certain owners or kind of high profile people within those club hierarchies. So it will be interesting to see what comes of it. But as Steve said, hopefully it's something that isn't just forgotten about immediately. And like I say, I don't think it's not something you can solve overnight, but hopefully it acts as a catalyst for people to maybe think twice, both from a writing perspective and from a kind of reader perspective as well, to view it through a slightly different perspective and maybe, you know, have that in the back of their minds when they're reading a story which, you know, seems unnecessarily negative based on nothing more than, you know, the colour of someone's skin or their background.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for your thoughts and comments today. Tell the folks where they can find you.
Thanks for listening, guys. I've been Jim. You can find me on Twitter at JimKnight88. As Kev says, I'm a writer about football, primarily for my day job. I work for a company called The Zone. I used to be Perform, and we own websites like Goal.com and Soccerway. So you can find more of my writings over there on less sensitive topics than this. But yeah.
And thanks very much for having me on again, Kevin. I enjoyed it as always. My name's Steve McGugan, and you can get me on Twitter at Steve McGugan, and you can find some of my non-football thoughts over at Northern Slant, at Northern Slant. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks again to you two and folks at home. We hope you keep listening.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.